Sprinkled throughout his career from Lord Leary's castle right on, Lowell was perpetually described by critics and other leading poets as the greatest poet of his time. Do the accolades for Robert Lowell still hold up?
I think they do, yes. I mean, he may be slightly out of fashion here now, and that's my feeling. And this often happens to a poet within the few years immediately after his death. There's a sort of general falling off. But I would have said that that in years to come, when the record is established, that Lowell will be thought of as the most important American poet of the post-war years, yes.
He had a tremendous following in Britain, I know. As a matter of fact, one of his more important books was a book of collected poems that was published only in England. Actually, there were two books of collected poems published only in England. And what do the British think about Lowell?
Well, again, his reputation there was particularly high during the 60s, where he was represented to British poets as an exemplary figure, a figure who represented power and passion and verbal strength of a type that English poetry seemed to be lacking in at that point. And a lot of people, I think, did follow his example. And there were other connected American figures like John Berryman and Sylvia Plath who were making an impact in Britain at around the same time. So there was a mini American invasion during the 60s.
I was going to ask you about Lowell's stature as compared to the other major poets of his time. You mentioned Berryman, but there was also Delmer Schwartz and Alan Tate and Jarrell,
yes.
How does Lowell stack up?
Well, it's always very difficult to sort of rate poets in that way. I mean, to me, he stacks up as number one in relation to the poets you've just named. Other people would take different views, but I think that the consensus during his lifetime, certainly since the book Life Studies, which was published in 1959, was that he was the most all-round, best-equipped poet of his generation. And I think that still holds for me.
How do you establish the greatest poet, or the greatest author? It doesn't seem to make sense because poetry as an art or as in any phase of life, there are so many aspects to it, so many personalities, and so many ways of expressing things, that how can one human being be singled out as the greatest poet, as Lowell has been many, many times?
Well, quite. I mean, it's always finally a matter of individual taste, but this did tend to happen to Lowell, and it does tend to happen, I think, in America. And Lowell and poets of his generation were very conscious of this ranking business, who was the champ. Lowell was interested in that kind of thing, although in a rather oblique and crafty way, I think, whereas a poet like Theodore Retke, for example, was quite blatant in his sort of determination to be top of the poetic league table and was full of competitiveness and rivalry of a sort that you expect in, you know, business boardrooms, but not in the, not on the slopes of Parnassus.
Lowell never filtered down into secondary school textbooks the way, say, Robert Frost did. There were young people in the 50s and early 60s who read Frost and were amazed to find out that Frost was still alive because he had been around for so many years writing. His poems had been in their textbooks for so long they thought he was one of the pioneer poets. But that never has happened to Lowell, has it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know about the sort of American schools as well as you do, obviously. I would think it might happen. I think there are poems of Lowell's, particularly a poem like For the Union Dead, which is a part public, part private poem. It's a poem about America. It's a poem about sort of American history. And it's a poem that it seems to me would be eminently teachable. And I think that the teachability of a poem often determines whether it gets into the school curriculum rather than its merits, perhaps.
You say teachability, and yet there are so many of Lowell's poems that are so obscure, so biographical, that one, it would take the reading of a book such as your biography in many instances to understand what Lowell was talking about. And indeed, in your book, you say that many of his poems remain indecipherable. Mm-hmm. You have tried to check out the people apparently referred to in these poems to find out what Lowell was saying. But didn't Lowell put an unfair burden on many of his readers by being so indecipherable?
I think at certain stages of his career, yes, this could be said. In his early poems, I think a lot of them remain impenetrable. And they were the product of a view of poetry which was a minority elitist view. It felt that poetry was something that involved hard work, hard reading, a lot of scholarly background and so on. This was the view that was adopted by the group of poets that Lowell had to do with in the late 30s and early 40s, and that produced the type of obscurity that one got in the early poems. In the later poems, the obscurity, when it occurs, is much more to do with idle, autobiographical, sort of throwaway lines that you need to know who X was and who Y was in order to get anywhere sort of near some of these poems. And that is rather off-putting, I agree. But I think that in the middle of those two extremes, you have some very lucid, very available work, the work in Life Studies, it seems to me. You don't need footnotes to follow. They're very powerful, direct, personal poems about a man in a state of extreme suffering, and it's fairly clear what the extreme suffering is and what he's saying about it. So I think the obscurity crops up at the beginning and it crops up at the end, and there are two different types of obscurity, but the middle work, which in my view is the best work, doesn't seem to me to have that fault.
You mentioned the scholarly appraisal of Robert Lowell, and yet Lowell was an absolutely wretched speller. You are very accurate in reproducing his letters in your book. And some of the simplest words Lowell appears to have blocked out. Mm. Isn't there an inconsistency there somehow?
It's certainly very strange, yes. I mean, some people say that he suffered from a form of dyslexia. And certainly his handwriting to the end remained the handwriting of a 13-year-old. In fact, my son, who's 15, saw some of Lowell's letters and was greatly heartened. He thought, well, if this famous poet could write like this, perhaps I'm not so bad after all.
My son, who's 14, would feel the same way. He has yet to learn to spell or to read, I think.
Yeah.
Lowell was more than a poet. He was also a political activist, and he refused to attend the Johnson White House Conference on the Art. He marched in anti-Vietnam demonstrations. He campaigned for Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was running for the presidency. How did such political involvement affect Lowell's reputation as a poet?
I think it helped it, probably. I mean, it made him the representative poet. So I think in 1965, if America in general had heard of any poets, I mean, Robert Frost aside, it would have been Robert Lowell. And in some way, he did take these stands and feel himself to be representing the arts, representing that aspect of America. And where he got that sense of his own representative importance from, it's hard to say. It must have had something to do with being a Lowell, being an American aristocrat. And it may well, at certain points, have had something to do with his manic illnesses and so on, which certainly did encourage a degree of megalomania. But I think that they made those particular involvements you mentioned made him a better known poet, and to that extent certainly helped his reputation. I don't think they harmed it at all, no.
Lowell's family name was such that he was almost preordained by his family history to launch him into the pinnacle of some kind of success. Isn't that true?
It does seem so, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that when he refused military service in 1943, he doesn't just write his letter to the local draft board, he writes it to President Roosevelt himself and says, as a member of an old family writing to another member of an old American family, I hereby tell you I'm not going to fight. He had that sense, yes.
That did not seem to be a very rational act, but then nobody ever accused Lowell of being rational anyway. He was extremely inconsistent with regard to his feelings, I think, about the war. Being a conscientious objector was one thing, and yet he had volunteered previously to serve in the military and even subsequently in a non-combatant form. Do you think that this letter to Roosevelt at the time may have been indicative of what later was going to show up as his instability?
I do incline to that view, yes. I came to think that. It all seems to have happened in the space of about 7 days. As you say, up to then, he was trying to enlist. Indeed, he'd been turned down several times on the grounds of eyesight, and would have been turned down, probably, a seventh time. I think he tried to enlist about six times. Then in the space of a week, he changed and suddenly produced this this letter. Well, it could be said that the saturation bombing that was his specific objection, this is why he refused to fight, because he disagreed with that policy, had only become general American policy during that particular week. But it all seemed to me a bit too hasty and a bit too grand scale. And knowing what we do later about his mental troubles, I do incline to think of that as an early undiagnosed manic episode. Yes,
he indeed was a manic depressive. How do you describe his psychological problems over all of those years, and how were they ultimately dealt with?
Well, it's hard to describe them in a few words. A manic depressive illness can take many forms. In Lowell's case, it took the form of what he called pathological enthusiasm. He would have bouts of a sustained high hyperactivity. He would have megalomaniac delusions. He would have religious delusions. He would have paranoid delusions. He would, on occasions, fall in love with some utterly inappropriate lady and decide he was going to throw over his old life, take up with this new girl. He would buy her an apartment and announce to all his friends, and indeed to his wife, that he was going to get married. And all this turbulence would last for maybe sort of 2, 3, 4 weeks until finally he was hospitalized. He was treated with one or another of the psychiatric drugs, or indeed with electric shock therapy, and he would gradually come down, and he would then move into the depressive stage of the manic depressive cycle, and then he would be humble and ashamed and contrite and assessing the damage that he'd done during this hyperactive few weeks before he'd been hospitalized. And this cycle recurred, and throughout the 60s it was recurring on an annual basis. So for sort of 3 or 4 months, really, of every year, Lowell was at one point or another in that cycle. And it took its toll.
Did this continue until his death?
It did, really. He in the late 60s, I think 68, he began to be treated with the drug lithium, which was thought to be the new wonder drug that would cure manic depressive illnesses. And for a time it did seem that it was working. And I think he went for some 4 years, from 1970 to 74. This is after he'd moved to England and divorced and married for the third time. He had this 4 year stretch of tranquility, and I think during that period, which was the period in which I in fact knew him, he did feel confident that this thing had been licked, that this drug was the cure. And then tragically he broke down again, and then again, and then a third time before he died in 1977.
He certainly had a dramatic personal life. Tell me about his personal life, his marriages, and a little bit about all of the affairs. Apparently he became involved with many of his students.
Yes, I think there were involvements with students. And I think that perhaps one can, when too much can be made of all this. I don't know how much sort of damage Lowell actually did in his life to these various girlfriends he took up with. My impression is not a great deal of lasting damage. So one doesn't particularly want to dwell on that. And he had three marriages, the first to, all three to writers. The first to Jean Stafford, who is now dead, the short story writer and novelist, author of Boston Adventure. And that was a stormy, fairly short-lived affair. For most of that marriage, Lowell was a Roman Catholic. He had converted to Roman Catholicism, much to the horror of his Boston relatives, as you can imagine. And in fact, it probably was yet another act of sort of manic rebellion against his Boston past and the traditions he'd inherited. And so throughout the Stafford marriage, it was a ferocious Catholic business in which Jean Stafford was never quite Catholic enough for Lowell's taste. So that broke up, and then he married Elizabeth Hardwick. And that marriage lasted for some 20 years, and indeed, at the end of his life, I think he was intending to go back to Elizabeth Hardwick. And Elizabeth Hardwick, I think most readers of this book would agree, does emerge as the heroine of the book. Enormous loyalty and steadfastness and belief in him as a genius. And real love for him, clearly, which enabled her to withstand these repeated horrors of his illnesses and the humiliations of his manic affairs and so on, and all the awful public sort of mess that was involved. And she stuck it out very nobly and remarkably. And then in 1970 he left America for England and there married Caroline Blackwood, again a writer, novelist, and a member of the Guinness family, an Irish aristocratic lady. And for those 4 years, I think that was a fairly happy marriage, and Lowell felt renewed, reinvigorated, and so on by it. He was then in his 50s, 54, I suppose. But then the illnesses broke in on him again, and I don't think Caroline could take them. I don't think she knew how to handle them, but she was terrified by them. And she began to crack up herself under the strain. And so that marriage, I think, just gradually over the last 3 years of his life began to disintegrate, and Lowell began to look back to America and to Elizabeth Hardwick, to the things he knew and could be sure of, and to people who knew him and knew how to handle these episodes. And it seems that he was on his way back to Elizabeth Hardwick when he in fact died in a taxi cab on his way from Kennedy Airport to West 67th Street.
I think I should ask you to go back a little further to life studies, and American teenagers have a phrase, it's called doing a number on. And certainly Lowell, using that phrase, did a number on his father. And in reading subsequent poetry, it appears that he made an effort to atone for what he had thought and felt and wrote about his father. Can you very briefly tell me what his relationship was with his father and what happened subsequently?
Well, I think the key relationship was with his mother, and he was clearly absolutely fascinated by his mother as when he was a child, and remained fascinated by her to until she died. And so that was the intense relationship of his childhood. His father, who was a meek, timid, rather bullied figure, he tended to have contempt for, that it seemed to him that his father had simply sort of caved in. He'd given up the Navy because his mother had wanted him to give up the Navy. He'd given up certain of his friends because his mother wanted him to give up certain of his friends and so on. But he seemed to have no sort of spirit and no willingness to fight back and to rebel against the mother's regime. And so that's the way the father tends to get represented in the life studies period. I think later in his life Lowell came to see that that he had been too harsh in his judgment, that that the man was, after all, his father, and he was a pitiable figure and perhaps a weak figure, but that there were sort of generous and good-hearted elements there, which Lowell had never really given their due. And,
well, in, I believe it was History, he wrote a poem called Middle Age. Was it History?
Yeah.
It was, and the final stanza of the poem reads something to the effect that he... walking in the steps of dinosaur tracks.
Oh, this, the poem is in For the Union Dead, in fact, volume, yeah, yeah. That I am now walking in the steps, in your steps, yeah. Yes, well, he was then, I think as he became a father himself, I think this was, he'd just become a father when he wrote that poem, or at least 4 years earlier. So he perhaps was beginning to speculate about how his children may in due course have regarded him.
Tell me about your relationship with Lowell. How did you get to know him, and what was it like?
Well, I was the editor of a literary magazine called The New Review, which began publication in England in 1974. And we published several of Lowell's poems, the new non-sonnet poems he was writing, which were eventually published in Day by Day. And so I got to know him sort of as a sort of editor, and then slightly thereafter as a friend. We were never close friends, but we were close enough for me to visit him in hospital. And
so you went through some of his manic stages during his acquaintanceship.
Yeah, I did.
One last question, Ian Hamilton, and maybe we touched on this at the beginning of the interview, but how do you perceive the future and Robert Lowell? How will future generations look at this poet?
I think they will sort out the weak poems from the strong poems, I mean, fairly ruthlessly, I think. I think that Lowell did write and publish some poems that that won't last. But I think the two books, Life Studies and For the Union Dead, that some of the poems in the book Near the Ocean, and a number of the poems in his final book, Day by Day, I think will live and last.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This book was very timely. It has come out... following the publication of two other books that dealt very strongly with Lowell. One was called Poets and Their Youth.
Yes, I read that, yes. I mean, Simpsons.
And the other was American Aristocracy.
Yes.
That's a shorter, much more superficial biography, but one that gives you a good sense of, of what Lowell was like.
For the mistake.
Was it?
Yeah.
Fascinating man. The more I read, he's so enigmatic. His emotional state, his fiery life, makes him a person of great interest, I think.
Did you know him at all?
Did I know him?
Yeah.
No, I did not. I did move to New York approximately at the same time he was living here, but I did not know him.
Yeah.
I knew of him, and it wasn't until the last 5 or 6 years that I began to read those poems and reflect them. And as a matter of fact, after looking for 3 or 4 years, I finally found a copy of Lord Wyrie's Castle that I could afford.
Really?
It took me a long time to find it.
Yeah.
Because it's a very expensive book.
It's not easy
book,
to find,
unless you buy a paperback version of it, but I wanted to have the...
You've got the first edition of it?
I have first editions of all of his work, except
for the first one, The Land of Unlikeness.
The Land of Unlikeness, I don't have.
That's something like sort of $10,000.
That much?
Yeah.
If it was 250 sign limited editions of that.
It was very funny, when I was doing some of the interviews, I went to, first of all, to... I think Bob Giroux, and then to Jack Thompson, did interviews on
asked them about Land of Unlikeness, which I'd never seen.
I've never seen it. In any form.
Yeah, and each of them went to their shelves confidently to find it, to show it to me, and it wasn't there. In both cases.
Somebody knew.
Somebody knew.
Somebody knew.
Yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, there was a dealer who told me that he had had a copy, and it indeed was a cousin of Lowell's who had it, and it was inscribed to her, and she was putting it up for sale. Mm. What happened to it, I don't know. Mm. There are a couple of other Lowell's I do not have. I do not have, although it's available, but it's The Voyage.
Oh, yes.
I've seen it on many occasions, but it's a rather large book.
Yeah.
And it has normally come in very poor condition, that I found. And the other is, strangely enough, a very elusive book, Imitations.
Mm-hmm.
Imitations has been difficult to find. Now, it was remaindered this past year, and well, you can find a remaindered copy of it, but it's a temp printing.
Temp printing, right. So, I got the English first edition of that, not the American.
I have the English edition of Collected Poems, which is not a new, which is relatively new. I think it came in 70s.
Selected Poems.
Selected Poems.
Yeah.
But then there was another English edition that I referred to in the interview that was only printed in England.
Yeah, that was.
What was that called?
There is a Selected Poems that was only published in England, the one edited by Jonathan Raban, I think.
I'm not sure.
Paperback. But then there was...
No, it wasn't a paperback.
Then there was History. Well, there was three books were done here, weren't they? History, Felicity,
History
and
has just remaindered this year. Dolphin, first editions of History, 73, I think.
Yeah.
And you'll find it, you can go to one or more bookstores and find a rather large copy of History. But apparently History was not one of his more favored books.
No. Mm. Well, most of it is in Notebook, anyway. I mean, most of the poems are in History. Just rewritten sort of versions of the historical poems in Notebooks. So.
Well, let's see. There were three editions of Notebooks, I believe. As he kept, as you pointed out in the book, he could not, every time he saw a copy of the poem, he would have to rewrite it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's good.
Yeah,
I think that Notebook kept going downhill with each revision.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the smaller, more succinct version of Notebook.
Yeah,
and,
Notebook 1967 to 68. Yeah. Yes, I think I did. But he was absolutely compulsive, and he would sometimes give you a sort of poem and say, "What do you think of this?" And you'd say, just for something to say, you might say, "Oh well, you know, line three doesn't seem quite scratch." And he would sort of start crossing out line three and say, "Well, what do you suggest?"
He must have been very unsure. I noticed in your book you mentioned where the poets Everhart, I know, he's been before these same microphones, and we talked quite a bit about Lowell. And they would exchange poems.
Mm.
But most writers, they may seek opinion, but I'm not so sure that the majority of people would exchange poems and ask for criticism. I'm just not so sure.
Mm.
And indeed, when they got the criticism, they didn't like it much.
No. I don't want criticism, I want praise.
Were you able, you refer to Everhart a lot, were you able to talk to him?
Yes, I did talk to him a bit. I'd been to Dartmouth earlier, yes, and then we corresponded a bit. And,
where is the most definitive collection of Lowell's work?
In Harvard, really, in the Houghton Library at Harvard. And that's the
manuscripts?
Manuscripts, yeah. He sold, in 1968, he sold...
He sold them?
Everything to Harvard, up to that date, up to 68. And then...
What did Harvard pay for those manuscripts?
About, I think, $300,000 or $400,000.
Is that right? Yeah. Does he have anything at Kenyon?
Yeah, very little, very little. Surprising little, actually.
You would think that thing is alma mater, that would be a repository for the old...
No, I went there, but I was somewhat... rather disappointed to find how little there was.
What do people in Kenyon, do they have a feeling, a sense of Lowell?
A little bit, but I mean less, mean, Ransom was the great presiding sort of genius, you know. But now that he's dead, I think that a lot of that sort of seems to have fragmented and disappeared. I didn't really feel that, you know, that Lowell was a, you know, one of their favourite sons or anything particularly, no. But that may happen in the future, I suppose.
Do you read yourself? Do you read Lowell for enjoyment?
Oh, yes. Yes, sure. Yeah.
I find it impossible to sit down and read Lowell from cover to cover. I cannot take a book and read it. It is... much of his material is too difficult. I don't understand it. But what I tend to do, and usually with a drink, sometimes very late at night, Lowell can often make me cry.
Yeah. Mm.
And I will sit there and I will go through the book and I will pick out poems and lines and phrases that I like, that move me. Matter of fact, I think it's rather hard to read most poems. Although you're supposed to read Mills of the Cabin Law cover to cover, but yet it's still not that easy to do.
It's not that easy to do.
The vast majority of people.
No, it's Mills of the Cabin Law.
I certainly appreciate your coming in.
Well, I enjoyed it.
A magnificent book, and certainly the definitive biography of Lowell.